dedicated to the survival of American democracy in an increasingly dangerous world, this is Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney, acted as Assistant Secretary of Defense for International Security Policy under President Ronald Reagan, founder of the Center for Security Policy in Washington, D.C., the go-to man for defense and foreign policy issues, joined by the greatest minds in the security policy business, the special forces in the War of Ideas at Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome to Secure Freedom Radio. This is Frank Gaffney, your host and guide for what I think of as an intelligence briefing on the war for the free world. A man of uncommon intelligence, with whom we have the privilege of working from time to time, is Dan Pollack. He is the Director of Government Relations at a marvelous organization, the Zionist Organization of America. As it happens, he is a former naval officer in the U.S. Navy's submarine forces, and he has had jobs in the private sector as well, of course, as the ZOA. But we wanted to visit with him specifically about some of the things his organization has been saying and writing about in terms of the deal of the century, as President Trump has proclaimed it, the vision for peace between the Israelis and the Palestinians unveiled a week or so ago. Dan Pollack, welcome back to Secure Freedom Radio. It's good to have you with us. So give us just kind of the 30,000-foot level. We won't have time to do justice to this topic, but I'd be very interested both in how you would characterize this peace plan and your somewhat selective acclaim for it.
Well, President Trump has been an outstanding president for the American-Israel relationship, and we thank him for that. This plan gets kind of a qualified endorsement. We put out a paper with 30 excellent points about the peace plan, and there are some very good things in it. We don't come out and endorse it explicitly, and there's good reason for that as well, which I could be happy to go into. The basic idea is that if the Palestinian Authority and the Palestinian Arabs would accept Israel as a permanent member of the nations in the area, all kinds of things could be possible, and that's what this peace plan talks about. The conditions, though, are so far removed from what the reality is of the actual governance of the Palestinian Arabs that it's very difficult to see some of these things coming to fruition. But we have to be praising the president for his far-sighted vision in recognizing certain principles. And those are the things that, you know, no transfer of population, Israel does have a legitimate claim. There's many, many things that are positive. On the negative side, once a peace plan is put forward by the United States, one worries that in the future, if there should ever be Palestinian Arabs that are ready to, in good faith, negotiate the future of the region, which is not the case now, unfortunately, some of these things will be the starting point and the least acceptable position. And there are some significant Israeli concessions in this document. And it's kind of negotiating with yourself because the Palestinian Arabs refuse to come to the table once again.
Well, this is sort of negotiating 101, isn't it? That you don't want to make your bottom line or something approaching it the starting point for the negotiations. And that would be of concern, I think, and presumably is to Benjamin Netanyahu. Is your reading of this embrace of the plan by Bibi, as much as anything, a desire, of course, to have there be no daylight between him and Donald Trump, but also that it's in the confident expectation that the Palestinians aren't going to accept, that even making these kinds of concessions up front is not as troubling as he might otherwise perceive it to be?
I think that's the idea. There's something very dangerous about that. When you take it to the bank that your opponent will continue to be unreasonable, that's always something that places the ball in their court. They can suddenly decide to not be unreasonable. And we've always been a voice that has warned of that. Sometimes people are too clever in negotiations, and they take the idea that, well, we know that the opponent is intransigent, and therefore we can safely make these hypothetical concessions. There's two problems with that, as you said. What happens when somebody finally tries to negotiate in good faith? It's very difficult to take back something you've given, even if in theory nothing is given until everything is agreed to. And number two is we're placing the ball and the initiative in the court of our enemy. And that's not a great situation to be in either, where they get to decide exactly when they're going to change their own policy and place a... Now, as a practical matter, we don't take a position in Israeli politics, but it's well known they have an election going on. And Prime Minister Netanyahu has an interest in being seen as someone who's willing to make peace. The vast majority of the Israeli population would love being open to peace. We just think there are some realities about the actual character of our Arab interlocutors that prohibit actual progress from being made in the near future. On the other hand, there is a real opportunity with other Arab countries, and much of this plan is directed towards raising the ability of those countries to make peace with Israel. And we're going to see that, I think, in the near future. There's talk right now of Morocco establishing diplomatic relations with Israel. And there might be several countries who really care about their own interests above the Palestinian-Arab conflict with Israel and have a reason to make better relationship with Israel. And that's a very strong positive, as long as we don't give up vital American or Israeli interests. I mean, it's just as much an American interest as an Israeli interest.
We lose sight of that at our peril, I think, that when we make Israel less secure, that's actually detrimental to our vital interests as well as those of the Jewish people in Israel. Let me ask you about one other matter. One of the things that I've always prized about ZOA under the leadership of your great president, Mort Klein, a man who we've honored with our Keeper of the Flame Award, as a matter of fact, so much is our admiration for him and his work and yours. But you've been willing to stake out principled positions, whether they are deemed to be politic or not. And sometimes that's put you at odds with the government of Israel. Sometimes that's very much put you at odds with the United States government. But you've held firmly to principled positions. And I think that's been vital, both for our interest as well as those of Israelis. Let me ask you very quickly, you've called for Bibi Netanyahu to do something that he said he will do. Now, I think it may be political positioning, who knows, but talk a little bit about why Israel should formally annex the areas in the so-called West Bank, Judea and Samaria, in which there are important Israeli settlements.
This plan, one of the good things about it is it seems to make a provision that Israel's case to be the actual legitimate owner of Judea and Samaria, what people erroneously call the West Bank. It's kind of an archaic term. It would be a little bit like, calling the United States the colonies. I mean, this is a former status. But we just make a quick correction. We don't call it annexation because the land never stopped belonging to the Jewish people, actually. And it has been recognized as such under international law since World War I and the treaties that ended it. That territory was allocated for the establishment of a Jewish homeland. So it's been disputed territory, and Israel's sovereignty will be extended, we hope, in two stages, probably, to areas around Jerusalem where there are a majority Jewish homes. These are, people call them settlements, but they're really communities, and they're well-established suburbs of Jerusalem. In the first case, the more far-flung settlements, they call them settlements, the communities in Judea and Samaria, are also provided for in this plan. And the second place where sovereignty probably needs to be extended is along the Jordan River. There's a natural barrier there that is vital to Israel's security. The Jordan River itself, for those of you who have been there, isn't much of a big river. It's many people would call it a stream in many places. But there are mountains on either side of it that are tremendously important from a strategic point of view. And Israel has said that its security requires that that territory remain part of Israel at the end of any negotiations. And therefore, sovereignty is actually a way of helping the peace process in both areas, areas that will never possibly be given to any other political entity.
Because they are vital to the strategic position of Israel and its ability to withstand attack from the neighbors. We have to leave it at that. I'm sorry to say, Dan, we are over time. Thank you very much for yours today and for the expertise you bring to the cause and the great work that the Zionist Organization of America does. I know you'll keep it up and hope you come back to us soon. Next up, we'll speak with Diana West about the President's State of the Union address and socialism versus communism. Is there a dime's worth of difference? That and more straight ahead.
Visit us at facebook.com/securefreedom with Frank Gaffney. You're listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney from the nation's capital in Washington, D.C.
We're back, joined as we have the privilege of being each week by Diana West, a nationally syndicated columnist for many, many years, a woman who continues to contribute actively to the public policy debate through her terrific blog, dianawest.net, and through other publications, notably the Epoch Times. She is the author of three magnificent books, Death of the Grown-Up, American Betrayal, and most recently, The Red Thread, A Search for Ideological Drivers Inside the Anti-Trump Conspiracy. Diana, good to have you back. Welcome. Well, there was a lot of evidence of the anti-Trump conspiracy in the State of the Union address last night, and I wanted to get your reading on what it says about really the state of our union, that we find ourselves riven so powerfully, not just by an antipathy towards Donald Trump, I think it's fair to say, but this vehement rejection on the part of Democrats, Nancy Pelosi, obviously, particularly, but the ladies in white and the rest of them, for, well, America first policies, but I would call them just pro-American policies that the president has espoused.
Yes, this really is a divide between the Democrats and America. I don't see any other way to really characterize it when you see the Democrats sitting on their hands in their ghostly white uniforms in judgment, really, on the existence of America and finding us guilty. I mean, in terms of all of the successes that President Trump has racked up in his 3 years in office, despite the rolling coup, impeachment, etc., investigations, etc., and not applauding the comeback of America, as the president says. They are, at this point, the anti-American party. We don't even get to a point where we discuss America first versus internationalism in the globe. This is about America here domestically, and it's a shocking but so valuable, so vital lesson that the president once again teaches us simply by calling them out, by calling America up and seeing the Democratic reaction, including the Speaker of the House literally ripping up his speech in the aftermath, which was really one of the most memorable moments in an otherwise quite memorable State of the Union. But this really was the capper.
Oh, it's most deplorable, I think it's fair to say. Diana, your book, The Red Thread, talks about ideological drivers behind this effort to take down the president. The president spoke to, you know, the ideological fight we have on our hands at the moment. He used, interestingly enough, the constitutional president of Venezuela, Juan Guaido, who was, to, I think, the president's great credit, in the First Lady's box, there, you know, to be applauded, as he was, quite vigorously by the Congress assembled, to showcase, really, what socialism really entails. The terrible tragedy of his country being a prime example. What were your thoughts on watching that spectacle?
Yes, well, this was another one of these lessons that the president is able to bring to the American people when he discusses how socialism destroys nations. I mean, this was one of his phrases: socialism destroys nations. He said, but always remember, freedom unifies the soul. Well, freedom does even more than that in terms of the life of a nation. It is the life of a nation, and he made that point very clear. And he further discussed the record of those same Democrats sitting on their hands in the House in his discussion of socialist medicine, which I think he cited 132 Congress members had actually voted for. So this was his continuing theme. He's made this a centerpiece of his administration, which I believe makes him this counter-revolutionary figure, which has kind of summoned into the open the hidden socialists and communists and collectivists and progressives. These are all names that essentially describe the same thing inside the government, both as open both as elected representatives and bureaucrats who have absolutely seized the levers of power over the generations of our system in order to socialize the country, in order to take us to a socialist state of being. And President Trump's whole agenda is an obstacle and indeed an engine of reversal of this bind that we have come to be in. And that, I think, is really what accounts for the what we call the coup against him and this continuing insurrectionary behavior of the left, of his opponents in his own party.
The revolutionary behavior, I think, to stay with your analysis here. And Diana, you wrote a very important piece, I think, in the Epoch Times on the 3rd of February that sort of takes this fundamental dynamic and puts it into a larger ideological context with respect to the putative difference between socialism on the one hand and actual communism on the other. And the title of it was Marx didn't distinguish between communism and socialism. Why should we? Walk us through that, if you would.
Yes, well, that is actually a quotation from a council of one of the great investigating committees of the 1950s, one that looked into the socialist impact and furtherance of foundations, a number of foundations. The Rees Committee by a man named Rennie Wurmser, who wrote a book about foundations, charitable foundations. And when I read that line from his book, he discussed all of this, and he made that point that Marx himself did not distinguish between socialism and communism. And I found that absolutely illuminating. And indeed, this is true. And I do have to sort of make the comparison to in the period after 9/11, when we were trying to distinguish between different forms of Islam, different schools of Islam. Well, when this one says what that one says, and ultimately the impact on non-Muslims is ultimately the same. It becomes kind of ludicrous to get too bogged down. Similarly, with communism, socialism, progressivism, we were working with Alinskyism at the time of the Obama administration. These different isms are simply words that confuse us and that make it hard for us to even armor up against the inexorable and common drive toward collectivist, state-run world. Socialism is the object of all of these different programs in the sense of central control of the individual and of our liberty and of our economic life and private life, etc. And so this becomes an encumbrance to us in order to really stand up for our freedoms, for our Constitution and our Bill of Rights. And so I think it's very important that people understand that these are just words and that the essential struggle is between anti-communists, people who want to stand up for liberty, individual liberty, and Marxist, communist, progressive, Alinskyites, etc., who are trying to take it away and control it for themselves, socialists.
What, as an intellectual level effort, I guess, what is the difference between socialism and communism? Is it the degree to which the state, the central authorities, use coercive means to accomplish their ends, or is there really not a dime's worth of difference? It's just a question of at what stage of the revolution do you find themselves controlling the reins of power and therefore abusing them?
Well, I think in a way, I think it just depends where it is being driven forward and what the culture is like and what the people are like. I mean, we do see variations, of course. Socialism is allegedly supposed to be the kinder, gentler form that can be enacted democratically, at least for a period of time. But I think you hit the nail on the head when you invoke the word coercion. They are all coercive programs, and they attend to make people into subjects, not citizens with rights. But yes, there are certainly differences. They argue about them. They fight each other. They unite against the common enemy being the free market and people involved in it holding on to liberty, the anti-communists. I mean, there are. It is sort of like the notion of different sorts of Muslim schools that will fight each other and yet then unite against the infidel. So they are essentially moving in the same direction and pose the same threat to liberty. And so therefore the differences are less important to us in terms of trying to protect our liberties than they are to them, who can argue each other.
Dina, lastly, and very quickly, we've got less than a minute. Do you subscribe to the view that Nazism is an ideology of the left as well, not of the right, as we're so often told?
Oh, absolutely. No, I mean, all of these fascists, I mean, again, these are words that political scientists invent to try to describe movements and political movements. So these things are not, written in stone with these obdurate differences. But yes, absolutely, on the left in the same way, and very often allied, even as they fight each other, then they unite. I mean, we saw the Nazi-Soviet Pact, of course, as an object lesson here. So yes.
And therefore, we must be steeled against all of them and not be misled into believing that, there's a moral equivalency between right and left on this fundamental question of threatening freedom. Dinah West, your clarity on all of these issues is so important. Thank you for joining us. Thank you for the work you do at dinahwest.net and elsewhere. Come back to us again next week, if you would. Next up, we will speak with Mark Helprin right after this.
Now more with Frank Gaffney.
I couldn't be more pleased to welcome you back and to also welcome our next guest, a dear friend, a hugely admired author and highly regarded essayist, Mark Helprin. Now, there are other people who have a similar name. Don't be confused. I'm talking about the one who has been a senior fellow of the Claremont Institute for the Study of Statesmanship and Political Philosophy for many years, a member of the Council on Foreign Relations, and a prodigiously successful author, both of fiction and nonfiction works, including most recently Paris in the Present Tense. This Mark Helprin has written an extraordinarily important piece that I wanted to turn to, even though it came out several months ago. We have difficulty sometimes catching up with one another, but I'm always pleased when he is available. And let me just welcome him back to Secure Freedom Radio. Mark Helprin, Happy New Year to you, sir. It's great to have you with us.
Thanks, Frank.
So the article was entitled, Treat China as the Nuclear Superpower It Is. It appeared in the Wall Street Journal in November. Most people will tell us, all the cognoscenti about these matters, that China only has 200, well, maybe 400 nuclear weapons. This would put it slightly ahead of Pakistan, I think. But you don't credit that account, as I take it.
No, I mean, this is something that's very low on people's horizon, because people in general prefer not to think about anything nuclear. And when they do, they don't think about it rationally. But here's the thing about China. They have 3,000 miles, which, think about that. That's New York to Los Angeles. 3,000 miles of underground tunnels in which they manufacture, store, and deploy their nuclear deterrent. And we don't know what's going on in those tunnels. So it's possible that they could make a nuclear breakout, which would stun the world. And a lot of American nuclear strategists believe that nuclear sufficiency is all that one needs. In other words, if you have enough to destroy your opponent's cities and industry and a good deal of its population, no one will ever mess with you. And therefore, that's all you need. But they're not taking into account a lot of other factors, such as the fact that it's the opponent that decides for himself what is sufficient. And people have different nuclear doctrines, and they're willing to accept different levels of damage. And they have different perceptions of what you're willing to do and what they would do, etc. So sufficiency is not enough. It also doesn't take into account the psychological factor of having, for instance, an overwhelming arsenal, as we once had vis-a-vis other small countries which wouldn't dare take us on. And then there's another strategic factor, which is this, and that is that if you have a first strike and then you have a retaliatory strike, if the opponent has enough to then completely destroy you, then overkill is what will give him an advantage. Now, these things are arcane. They seem arcane to most people. But in fact, China is in the position of, let's say, that Russia was in when we were competing with Russia, but we know nothing about what China is doing. We even the left always insisted that we know what Russia was doing. That's the whole their focus on arms control, on verification. We want to know what they're doing. We don't know what China's doing.
In those tunnels or elsewhere, for that matter. And Mark Halperin, I really salute you for calling attention to this, as you often do, with things that really deserve our focused consideration and all too often don't get them. But China's nuclear threat is actually, interestingly enough, a topic we addressed in a poll that we just conducted by McLaughlin and Associates, one of the country's, I think, preeminent polling firms, of American voters' attitudes about China. And it was pretty clear that on many of the topics that we were interested in evaluating their thinking, they hadn't been thinking about these things at all. They simply didn't have the information that they needed. And that's certainly true of the 3,000 miles of tunnel, the so-called underground Great Wall of China. When we gave them information in the poll, they wound up, by and large, responding very favorably, very much along the lines of what you and I and other members of the Committee on the Present Danger China would recommend. And I really just want to underscore this point. What was fascinating about it, and by the way, the poll is available in its entirety at presentdangerchina.org, the website of the Committee on the Present Danger China, including a presentation by John McLaughlin, the pollster himself, that we will be taping in the course of the day today and that we'll be posting this evening. But I just want people to be aware, Mark Halperin, that what you're talking about, when the 1,000 likely voters were exposed to this information across all of the demographic groups, the response was very much, as we would hope, that people were quite concerned, quite alarmed, really, by what this portends in terms of China's nuclear threat to this country, point one, but more broadly, its larger ambitions. And would you just talk a little bit about those ambitions and how this nuclear buildup would fit into what Xi Jinping's China dream, as he calls it, entails?
I'd like to bring up something that even the poll didn't bring up. It is kind of arcane, but I think it's understandable. And that is the question of low-yield nuclear weapons. Among the many things that China can do in its secret 3,000 miles of tunnels is manufacture low-yield weapons and deploy them. And in America, the Democrats, who now control the House, are against the United States having an equal capacity. They say, in fact, Adam Smith, the Democratic representative from Washington,
the chairman of the House Armed Services Committee.
That's right. Obviously very influential, said, and it's hard for me to believe this as someone who has been involved in this nuclear strategy for most of his life. He said, look, we don't need low-yield weapons because if anyone uses a low-yield weapon, we're going to kick, he literally said, we're going to kick their ass. In other words, a general nuclear exchange. That is so crazy because, let me give you a hypothetical example. Let's say that China, for example, gets in a war with the United States over the South China Sea, a conventional war, and they decide to escalate and take out Guam with a low-yield nuclear weapon. And then what are we going to do? We're going to have a general nuclear exchange and attack China with all our nukes, and then have them respond from their nuclear submarines, which we would not be able to eliminate, in bastions that are protected by their superior number of submarines to our Navy, and destroy us. We won't do that. We wouldn't do that. But if we could, for example, hit a small Chinese target with a low-yield nuclear weapon, that might stop the escalation. And the same goes for Russia. Russia has a nuclear strategy different from our own. They say, they really believe, and they state this, that if they use low-yield nuclear weapons against small targets, that will stop the escalation and it will also give them victory. But on the other hand, if we could respond with a low-yield nuclear weapon, then they won't even take that first step to do that. But if our only response is to destroy them completely and then have our own country destroyed completely, we're not going to do that, and they know it.
Well, as it happens, Mark Halperin, we spoke a short while ago, and we'll be running after your segment, conversation with Dr. Peter Vincent Pry, who addressed a similar concern, that there is this disparity. The Russians are estimated to have 10 times the number of tactical nuclear weapons that we have. Ours are either obsolete or simply inadequate in numbers. We've tried to address that under the Trump administration very recently with the deployment of something that's been wrongly described as a new nuclear weapon, the modification to an old one, a warhead known as the W-76. This is the W-76 version 2. It's basically just a lower yield version of that weapon. Peter Pry has some concerns about the value of this. Not that he thinks we don't need something like it. It's just his concerns relate specifically to the platform on which this weapon will be placed and the compromise that it might result in if it ever has to be used in ways that could be very dangerous for our overall deterrent posture. What are your thoughts about this W-76-2?
I don't know if you know, but it just came out recently, maybe today, I don't know, that we have deployed one, at least one, on a Ohio-class nuclear submarine. And that may alleviate some of his concern, because those are more or less invulnerable. And not that they'll be that way forever.
Well, I think his concern, Mark, is that if you actually fire one of these missiles, you would be compromising the position of that submarine. You also, I think you hear from the left as well, this argument that, well, how will the Russians know that it's not a strategic nuclear weapon that's raining down large numbers of weapons on them, which might precipitate a larger exchange? That's another set of concerns, but this particular one, I think, is it may, by virtue of it not being designed to be a low-yield weapon and a relatively clean one, a less than satisfactory response to a very large and real concern.
Yeah, well, a couple of things. One, that's true. We should have specific weapons that are known to be what they are. You have to be clear when you do any kind of deterrence. And the second thing is that the Russians would know, because it would be a single missile, and not going to have a general nuclear exchange with a single missile not directed toward their heartland. So that's one thing. But yeah, in general, we have to be clearer about this, and we have to actually state in our doctrine that we are prepared to face off their doctrine in the same way. And that's really the only thing that would discourage them from embarking upon a very, very dangerous course of action that their doctrine now permits. They've always had a very promiscuous nuclear doctrine.
Right. And you're suggesting here that it's not just the Russians who are troubling in this way, but also the Chinese as well. Mark Halperin, we have to leave it at that, I'm afraid. There's so much more to talk about. Would you come back for an hour with us? It's been a long time since we've had a proper visit, and I hope we can do that very soon, if you would. We'll talk more about all of this with Dr. Peter Vincent Pry right after this. Thank you, Mark Halperin. God bless you.
Go to securefreedomradio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio. Go to securefreedomradio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
We're back. We're joined by Dr. Peter Vincent Pry, a national treasure by my lights, a man who has spent his entire professional life, whether it was at the Central Intelligence Agency, whether it was on Capitol Hill in a succession of committee positions, including with the House Armed Services Committee, and most especially in connection with his role as a staff member for two very important commissions, the Congressional Electromagnetic Pulse Commission and the Congressional Strategic Posture Commission, in which he played an outsized role in helping those commissions make really important contributions to our understanding of various threats to our country and what needs to be done about them. He is the author of a number of books, including the newest, Blackout Wars, which describe the various challenges that we face to our country, to its very existence, from the phenomenon known as electromagnetic pulse, or EMP. Peter Pry, it's so good to have you back. Welcome. Well, we have a number of things to talk about, not a whole lot of time to do it. Let's move quickly through, first of all, the response, if one can call it that, to a series of exercises that the Russians have held in recent months. We've talked about them with you serially. Vast conventional and, in some cases, nuclear weapons exercises, including attacks against this country, presided over, at least in one case that I know of, by Vladimir Putin himself. What is NATO's response that is scheduled, I guess, for sometime a little later this spring?
Right. NATO's response is an exercise Defense Europe 2020, which is being described as the largest NATO U.S. Military exercise in 25 years. And it's a pretty pathetic response. The big deal will be moving 20,000 U.S. troops across the Atlantic to participate in the exercise that involves 17,000 European troops from 18 different countries. Okay, so the total exercise involves about 36,000, 37,000 troops, which is a pale shadow of what NATO used to do during the Cold War when we would have exercises of over 100,000 troops, which really sends a significant signal. Now, you have to put this in the context of exercises like Vostok 18 that Russia performed in 2018, that had 300,000 troops, 36,000 tanks and other vehicles.
So roughly 10 times the number of what NATO will be exercising. And ours have to get from here to there, which is a whole other kettle of fish, isn't it?
Yeah, that's right. And, these kinds of exercises, sometimes I wonder if it wouldn't be better not to hold them at all, because they could actually be provocative to show that our response to these massive Russian exercises, often partnered in by the Chinese, both conventional and nuclear exercises, elicit, such a pathetic response from NATO in return, especially compared to the Cold War days.
Peter, let me ask you about one other related thing, an artifact of the Cold War, are the Trident missiles and submarines that we built then, actually put them in train when I was in the Pentagon a lifetime ago. They are still sort of the front line of our nuclear deterrent posture, and steps have been taken recently, much to the outrage of the usual suspects in the U.S. arms control community, to put what has been described as a new warhead aboard some of the submarine-launched ballistic missiles in our Trident force. What can you tell us about the new capabilities that we have and the importance of them to maintaining deterrence in a period in which the Russians have been massively upgrading their nuclear forces and we have not?
Right. The so-called new warhead is the W-76-2. And you're right, the left has been screaming against the W-76-2 that we are escalating the nuclear arms race by doing this, which is utter nonsense. The Union of Concerned Scientists, Federation of American Scientists, the arms control community, they always ignore what the Russians have been doing. They have 10 times as many, at least 10 times as many tactical nuclear weapons as the United States. And they've been practicing, we were talking about the exercises, we've seen them exercise this strategy of escalate to de-escalate, where they will use tactical nuclear strikes, to de-escalate a war in Europe or Asia, figuring that we are so afraid of nuclear use that when they resort to limited tactical nuclear use to achieve decisive results in the battlefield, that we will back off. And because we've largely gotten rid of our tactical nuclear weapons, we only have 180 obsolete gravity bombs left over from the Cold War. They may well be correct. We don't have an equivalent proportional response to their big advantage in tactical nuclear weapons. The W-76-2 is intended to compensate for that, but it's not a new nuclear weapon of new design. What we basically did, is we took out the fusion part of a W-76-1 warhead, which had a much higher yield, and all that's left is now the plutonium trigger, which has a yield of about 10 to 15 kilotons. I object to this thing for other reasons, not that the left, first of all, the ballistic missile submarine fleet that you helped deploy during the Reagan years is arguably the most important part of our deterrent, because it's our instrument of last resort to protect our cities from being attacked in the event of a big nuclear war with Russia or China, those survivable ballistic missile submarines. But back in your day, in the Reagan administration, today is still your day, so apologize for that. But back in those days, we had 35 ballistic missile submarines, 35 to 40 of them at sea. In the fleet. Now we've only got 14, and it's going down to 12. And we don't have, even with the current fleet, we don't have the 400 equivalent megatons on that ballistic missile submarine fleet that would enable us, you know, to destroy 25% of their cities and 75%. That was all has always been regarded during the Cold War. That was regarded as the floor, that we couldn't afford to fall below that in terms of our retaliatory capabilities. And we have fallen below that. You know, the ballistic missile submarine fleet doesn't have the 400 equivalent megatons anymore. And now we're going to even further reduce the power of the ballistic missile submarine fleet because, you know, you're taking off, you're sacrificing 4 to 6 high-yield weapons to deploy one of these tactical nuclear weapons. And then, how usable is this thing? I mean, you know, the accuracy of the missile, it's supposed to be a battlefield weapon. You know, even though these have reasonably good accuracy, the idea of being able to insert this in a battlefield in an area that's not going to hurt your own troops, it's going to be a terribly dirty weapon because it's plutonium. You know, if you put it down on some place like Lithuania or the Baltic states, where it's likely to be necessary, it's hard to imagine that, like, the president of Lithuania is going to allow a Chernobyl to be dumped on his country. It's not a clean battlefield weapon.
I guess where I thought you were going with this was the possible use of a ballistic missile to deliver this warhead, for reasons you've mentioned, would also compromise the survivability of the platform. Is that a concern?
Exactly. It is a big concern. I mean, I've written a whole monograph on this, really, you know, because the global strike crowd is convinced, oh, this will be, they would be able to distinguish because of the trajectory, you know, that between this and a strategic strike. And that's not true. The Russians are going to assume the worst if they see a ballistic missile submarine launching even a single missile. You know, they might well overreact to that and decide that this is that we're escalating to the use of strategic weapons and then make a massive strike against our homeland. And then the survivability of the boat is put at risk, because as soon as you fire, they'll be able to locate that boat with their satellites and radars, follow the trajectory back to the launch origin, and plaster that area with nuclear weapons of their own.
Peter, so if I understand you correctly, you are not opposed to our having a deterrent to tactical nuclear weapons threats, which you consider to be very real, coming from Vladimir Putin and, for that matter, the Chinese. It's just they need to be modern. They need to be deployed in ways that make them effective as deterrents and don't jeopardize our other vital interests, like having a credible retaliatory capability in our submarine platforms. That all makes a lot of sense to me. I guess this is kind of a stopgap step, and it may be slightly better than nothing, but certainly not as good as we need. And again, as always, Peter, I appreciate so much your clarity on these issues, the thoughtfulness with which you approach them, and the ability that you have to help the rest of us make sense of some very difficult topics, many of which are, frankly, not being given adequate attention. I'd hope to talk to you more about electromagnetic pulse today, Peter, but we'll have you back on soon to do that, if we may. Thank you for your time today, as always, as well as the important work that you continue to do at the Congressional Task Force on National and Homeland Security. Come back to us again soon, if you would. I hope the rest of you will do the same again tomorrow. Same time, same station. Until then, this is Frank Gaffney. Thanks for listening.
You've been listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.